Hi, I'll bet somewhere in the universe there's an Earth guidebook, and I'll bet that book has a chapter that tries to explain why we Earthlings give tips to the kids who deliver our pizzas, but give squats to the ones that deliver our kids. Question: who will be the next player to enter the MLB Hall of Fame as a Pittsburgh Pirate, and has he or she been born yet? I'm Chris Rodell, and this is Use All the Crayons podcast. And today we're going to be talking about baseball, the game that taught me to be an optimist. It was in about 2005. We were attending a Pirate game, as we were often wont to do. We'd go to about 25 games a year. Rarely saw a winner. They'd win, what seemed like two of those games. That mattered a little because we had such a great time and often made new and interesting friends. The one was the case with Tom Zanit, whom I'll forever remember as the man Bill Mazeroski turned into a communist. So Tom is worthy of a brief sidebar. We met in Roland's down in Pittsburgh's Strip District. He was maybe 20 years older than us. Like all baseball fans of a certain age, our conversation eventually got around to Maz and Game 7. It was one of the most remarkable games in baseball history. Did he go to the game? He did not. And the reason why is one of my favorite hard luck baseball stories of all time. It was in 1960. Tom was a star-spangled rural Pennsylvania kid, a freshman ROTC student at Penn State. He believed in his government, its causes, and the prevailing domino theory. If we didn't stop them in Southeast Asia, we didn't need to stop them at Happy Valley. So when someone offered him a ticket to Game 7, he didn't think to get on a bus. He didn't shirk his duties. No, Tom marched, and marched, and marched. Hup, two, three, four, hup, two, three, four. Rather than make up a lie and go to what would become one of the most historic games in baseball history, Tom put on his uniform, and he drilled. "We drilled for about 3 hours that afternoon," he said. "Missed the entire game. About halfway through, I heard the campus break into bedlam. I knew something good, something remarkable had happened. And there I was, a huge baseball fan, and the only memory I have that day was hup, two, three, four, hup, two, three, four." Hearing that Maz had beat the Yankees on a Game 7 walk-off home run had a profound effect on the young Zanit. "I got so depressed that I, on the spur of the moment, went down to the Penn State Recruitment Center and enlisted to serve in Vietnam. My tour was 18 months. He was unprepared for what he saw during his service. I saw so much inhumanity, so many misguided policies," he said, "so much brutality. It changed my entire mindset. I went into that war being a true believer in the USA and left a communist. The war changed my whole outlook for the rest of my life." I heard that and I made a quick extrapolation. "So you're telling us that Bill Mazeroski turned you into a communist?" "I never really thought of it that way, but I guess you're right. Bill Mazeroski turned me into a communist." So we became chums, and soon we were meeting the communists for Bucko games. He brought interesting perspective to every game. None more so than when the hated New York Mets came to town. On this day, the Mets jumped out to an 8-run lead in the first inning. The Pirates, never a model of crackerjack efficiency, were looking particularly slapstick that afternoon. It looked like we were in for a long day. My buddy Paul suggested an alternative. "Let's get the hell out of here and go to a bar. These guys stink." The communist spoke up and gave me a life lesson I never forgot. "Oh, no, 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 no. We're not going anywhere. We now have the opportunity to witness something we'll never forget. We could be about to witness one of the greatest pirate comebacks in history." We stayed, and the Pirates lost 15-2. But his optimistic disposition changed the whole day. We stayed clear through the last pitch, and every pitch had us thinking rosy thoughts that this might be the pitch that turns it all around. It changed my life, and to this day I'm glad I became an optimist and not a communist. Many people dread the thought of being thrown under the bus. An optimist looks forward to the opportunity. He figures one day he'll become a really swell bus mechanic. He's one of the most unifying figures in the history of the Pittsburgh Pirates. He's raised millions for unfortunates, and wow, the man has 3,000 hits. Roberto Clemente? Nope, we'll get to him. We're talking Bob Nutting, the Pirate owner since 2007. He's a tremendous unifier. Everyone hates him. Worth $1.1 billion, Nutting, 57, raises millions for unfortunates by charging as much as $12 for warm domestic beer. Sure, he's the recipient of all that dough, but But I consider him unfortunate because he's one of those defectives that cares more about loot than love. As for Nutting batting 3,000 hits, I'm talking about the number of times each week disgruntled Bucko fans take to social media to call Nutting a cheap moron. Let's make it 3,001. My disdain for men like Nutting is usually on simmer. My stovetop is too busy boiling over things like climate change, the publishing industry, and my own multiple failures My stovetop is too busy boiling over climate change, the publishing industry, and my own multiple failures for it to have a free burner for someone as trifling as Nutting. But then something will happen with Nutting, and my hatred will resume its bitter potency. It happened in 2009, when I saw Nutting, where we were both attending a Bob Dylan, John Mellencamp, Willie Nelson concert. Instead of congratulating him for his musical tastefulness, I publicly berated him for putting profits over performance. I was just the other side of sober when I saw him. I said, "Bob Nutting, what are you doing?" He misheard me, and he said, "I'm doing great. How are you?" He approached with his hand extended like he was meeting a friend. He soon learned he was mistaken. I left his hand hanging there, a huge insult from a man like me, a reflexive suck-up around a multimillionaire. I didn't say, "How are you doing?" I said, "What are you doing?" He was on the defensive and started yammering about the future and how he was in charge of developing talent. I challenged each of his assertions. He recognized he was in a quagmire. He began to back away. "Well, I'm glad you still care." "I stopped caring when you traded Nate McClouth," I said. He's up to his old provocations, this time needlessly angering, of all people, the hallowed Clemente family. I'm not surprised. It was back in 2020, me and three high school friends spent the afternoon touring the Roberto Clemente Museum in Pittsburgh's Lawrenceville neighborhood. Its walls and exhibits are devoted to the great, the saintly Clemente. Clemente died December 31, 1972, at the prime of his life at age 38. He was the 11th player to get 3,000 hits. Only 21 others have achieved the milestone in the 47 years since. His dying with exactly 3,000 hits is divine symmetry, because in 50 years, 100 years from now, visitors to the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame will look at the list and its, who knows, 70 or 90 members by then, and all will focus on just two names, the first, whomever that may be, and the last, which for perpetuity will be Roberto Clemente. Sassy youth may wonder, who is this dude? Did he hang on past his prime to get that milestone hit and retire? Then some old-timer will tell him the story of Clemente. See, he had every intention of playing more productive years, but fate intervened. Clemente died in a plane crash on a mercy mission to take life-saving supplies to devastated victims of Managua, Nicaragua earthquake. The plane crashed on takeoff into the sea near San Juan, Puerto Rico. Each member of the Pirates attended his funeral, but one. It was his best friend, Manny Sanguian. He did not attend. He instead, with aching poignancy, spent the next 30 days diving in the ocean trying to find the body of his friend. The body was never found. Why Hollywood has never filmed the Clemente story is a mystery. But there's an even bigger mystery, and that's why Clemente's team refuses to acknowledge, much less support, his namesake museum. I learned this during my first visit and had it confirmed Sunday. Like a good attorney, I was asking a question to which I knew the answer. How much support does Bob Nutting and the Pirates give the museum? Gary, our guide, responded with evident bitterness. How much is 2 minus 2? The answer is nothing. Gary said he believes Bob Nutting thinks any dollar spent honoring Clemente is a dollar denied Bob Nutting. I say we prove him correct. If you're thinking of attending a Pirate game, consider instead touring the Clemente Museum. Shouldn't be too difficult. There were 20 in our group Sunday, or about 2 or 3 more than there were at the Pirate game. Score one for Roberto. Really, the whole notion is preposterous. A man like Nutting believing he's in competition with the ghost of the great Clemente. Of course, Nutting is nothing if not a shrewd businessman. Maybe he believes it's more profitable to compete with a ghost than to compete with the Cubs or the Cardinals. A pessimist dwells on the fact that smallpox killed 15 million people. An optimist says, hey, at least it wasn't bigpox. Here's a quote from Baseball Hall of Famer Roger Hornsby, 1942. People ask me what I do in winter when there's no baseball. I tell you what I do. I stare out the window and I wait for spring. I love the Hornsby quote because it summarizes the seasonal longings I feel during the depths of winter. It's particularly acute one day because the temperature was minus 180 degrees Fahrenheit. Not in Latrobe. That was the temperature deep inside all-time slugger Ted Williams' frozen head. I mention this now because I believe it'll take about 42 days, 12 hours, 8 minutes, and 37 seconds to thaw something that frozen and have it ready to suit up for the pitch hit for the next Pirates homestand. Williams' remains are among the 139 cryogenically frozen dead human beings and 39 pets, warehoused in the Scottsdale headquarters of Alcor, a company that one day intends to bring them all back to life. It's assumed, of course, that they'll have champagne, too, chilled for the eventuality. My guess is the MLB Players Union is litigating ownership to classify the former Red Sox, who died in 02, on some kind of really extended injured reserve. I'm surprised I don't hear more about the deep frozen body of the man admirers called the Splendid Splinter. He's one of my all-time favorite Americans. He was in 1941 the last man to bat 400. He hit left, but threw right. He had 521 home runs, but just 2,654 hits. How did one of the greatest hitters in baseball, many still consider him the best hitter in baseball, miss the milestone 3,000 hit club? He was a patriot. He served with historic distinction in not one but two overseas conflicts. He was a Navy fighter pilot with 3 years in World War II and later served 3 years in the Korean War, where he received the Air Medal and the two gold stars for valorous conduct during 39 missions. He was astronaut John Glenn's wingman in Korea, and Glenn said Williams was the best pilot he ever knew. So in the prime of his career, he lost 6 seasons to service. It's not inconceivable he could have snagged another 800 hits, enough to put him among the top 6 all-time hitters. Being in one Hall of Fame is historic. Williams qualifies for 3, baseball, aviation, and fly fishing. The International Group of Fly Fishermen, Fishing Hall of Fame features Williams for the many fly fishing records he's held. And he just seems like this great, boisterous guy. I remember ESPN airing an interview between him and late slugger Tony Gwynn, I love Tony too, about hitting, and it was just so joyful, these two old pros swapping stories, bantering, and laughing like the kids we all used to be. I think about Williams a lot this time of year, because thanks to Alcor, there's still a remote chance I'll get to meet him, even though he's been dead for about 20 years. Who's to say Alcor might someday succeed in revivifying Williams and the others from their deep freeze? That would be, well, what do you say, cool? It'd certainly give Williams the opportunity to be the future cinch for Comeback Player of the Year. His comeback promises to be the greatest since Jesus Christ, or maybe Austin Powers. And he'd look great in a Pirate uniform. Adding a Hall of Famer, even a dead one, wouldn't hurt would warm the fans' spirits. It couldn't hurt. Hell, the entire roster lost 105 games in 2010 and played as if they'd all been cryogenically frozen by, speaking of your Walking Dead, manager John Russell. Even at minus 180 degrees, Williams is bound to generate more warmth than Russell ever did. The fans would love to have someone as historic as Williams on the bench. Me and my buddies would be his number one fans. Heck, there are days, countless opening days, when we too were frozen. The bell is not working. Let's try again. I'll work on that later. Like the pessimist, the optimist is wrong about 50% of the time. The difference? The optimist is cheerful 100% of the time. Still not working. Miss Bryant's fine 1997 biography, Einstein, A Life, about perhaps the smartest man who ever lived. What I like about the book is it doesn't devote a lot of pages trying to explain to a moron like me Einstein's theory of relativity, which I find incomprehensible. I think it involves space, time, gravity, and the bending of light. I have my own theory of relativity, and I think it's better. It's certainly snappier. Here it is. When someone says they wish they had a big family, what they really mean is they wish they could pick who's in their family. That goes back to relatives and relativity. And nothing I've read of Einstein does anything to explain what to me is the most compelling question of all time. Where does all the stuff go when all the stuff goes into the black holes? Keeps me awake at night. So if I had all that stuff in, is way, way over my head. Why do I so enjoy reading about Einstein? Because perhaps the smartest man in history was such a joyful human being. He was whimsical, playful, curious, and considered each day a very precious gift. The man who regards his own life and that of his fellow creatures as meaningless is not merely unfortunate, but almost unqualified for this life, he said, his more elegant and moving answers at the end. He was a very human being, enjoying spending his days with friends and family, in conversation, with music, and a good smoke. It's a paradox, but his thoughts on life reveal to me that one of the most intelligent men in history was actually rather simple-minded. And that's about where the list of what me and Einstein have in common ends. I wonder how much it has to do with residential architecture. See, in the Dennis Bryan book, Einstein is forever going in and out of rooms the author calls the study. He sits alone in these rooms, these studies, and get this, he thinks. Thinks! Now, I've lived in or been shown hundreds of residences through the years, and never once has anyone shown me to a room called the study. I've been shown kitchens, living rooms, bathrooms, dining rooms, rec rooms, game rooms, man caves. Some southern homes tout frogs, front room over garage. Never once has any man or woman with evident pride said, and this is our study. I was in college for 4 raucous years and never once cracked a book in a room anyone called the study. Not only were their rooms weren't called studies, I rarely saw students doing what the room implies. What the hell happened to studies? I suspect they've been used to be what used to be the study has become the man cave, a room where me and my fellow Jurassics can go to fart, belch, and complain about the refs. And I'm talking both sportal and spousal. I consider yet another degradation of a once proud men like me. What I once called the family jewels are now somehow became my junk. From jewels to junk in 3 short decades. Sad. Well, I decided I wasn't going to let it defeat me. I'll not succumb to the further dumbing down of the American male. And yesterday I spent 2 hours in the finished basement room and tried to think of ways I can be more like Einstein. And eureka, it worked. Right there in my study, I thought about how I can be more like the great genius. I'm letting my hair grow crazy. Still doesn't work.
Amazon, retired sheep farmer, Crabtree, Pennsylvania. The day is, learn the fine art of knowing precisely when to quit.
Thank you.
Yes.